It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last weekend, 16 Democratic state attorneys general vowed to fight President Trump's executive order for travel bans. Iowa's attorney general, Tom Miller, was among them. The joint statement declared, as the chief legal officers for over 130 million Americans and foreign residents of our states, we condemn President Trump's unconstitutional, un-American, and unlawful executive order. It went on, religious liberty has been and always will be a bedrock principle of our country, and no president can change the truth. That was part of that statement issued by 16 Democratic state attorneys general. Now, Iowa-based journalist, historian, playwright Jeff Biggers joins us again. He took that statement as a jumping-off point, an opportunity to review Iowa's generous treatment of immigrants and refugees in the past. His piece for the Huffington Post this week is titled, Iowa, Meet Yourself. Can Attorney General Reclaim State Legacy on Refugees? Jeff Biggers, welcome back to our program.
Thanks for having me.
You write in your piece this week, for more than 150 years, Iowa has been one of the leaders in the nation as a model host state for refugees. Take us through a little bit of that history.
Right. Thanks, Ben. You know, I think often we look at the aspects of immigration and refugees with very little concept of our history. Especially when the media comes in, they can tend to see Iowa as this kind of flyover state that somehow people have this rooted culture that has no immigration background, and forgetting that, in fact, we're an incredible state of immigration, that we were founded just recently in the 1830s and 1840s and 1850s with these massive migration. There was an article in one of the newspapers in 1855 that talked about unprecedented immigration from around the world pouring into Iowa, and these are the movers and shakers of today. And so I went with that, was who are the movers and shakers? You know, if you just go down the road a little bit between Des Moines and Iowa City, for example, you come to the town of Pella. And Pella, of course, means the city of refuge. Pella was established by Dutch immigrants and refugees who were fleeing religious persecution, just like Muslims, and who really wanted to give a lasting sense, a lasting legacy to who they were. So they named their town after an ancient Jordanian city of Pella, which means the city of refuge.
I had no idea.
If you go further up to the northeastern part of our state, for example, there's a wonderful town up in the Driftless area called Elkader. And I think a lot of people think it's named after elk, the Elk Ader. But no, in fact, it's named after Elkader, Abdur Elkader, who was an Islamic revolutionary, someone who was very important. He influenced the whole world. Abraham Lincoln was really one of his great admirers. And he actually led all sorts of diplomacy, but even war in the Middle East. In the 1860s, Elkader, in fact, made sure that Muslims protected Christian refugees during the civil war in Syria. And so this little town in Iowa actually named their entire town Elkader after this Islamic revolutionary who was really famous world round for giving refuge to Christians. In that kind of context, I think if we see is that we have this incredible history that even has come up to current period, like, for example, in the 1970s.
Right. Let's talk about that a little bit, because that is in, with Jeff, you're in my living memory. We remember the 1970s. This is the aftermath of the conflict in Southeast Asia, the Vietnam War. A lot of refugees created that. Actually, let's cut to a little bit of sound from that you have embedded in your piece for the Huffington Post. This is 1979, the opening of the news, and this brings back memories to me. This is the opening of the CBS News in, I think, April of 1979.
This is the CBS Evening News with Morton Dean.
Soviet dissidents are not the only ones adjusting to new homes this weekend. Today, refugees from another land are beginning new lives in Iowa. Robert Jordan reports from Des Moines.
Although their steps may seem tentative, their minds filled with uncertainty, these Vietnam refugees, boat people, know they have arrived at a new home and a new start.
150 of these refugees are the first of 1,500 boat people that the state of Iowa has asked to resettle here. For each of them, the journey has been rough, a struggle for survival.
So there's a term from the past, the boat people from the 1970s. When Robert Ray did this, a Republican, it was not with the public sentiment, was it?
Right. In fact, a poll came out in the Des Moines Register that 51% of Iowans were unsure if they were going to support Governor Ray in this move. But Robert Ray was an extraordinary Republican. to me, he really kind of exemplifies the true Republican spirit we had in Iowa in that period. He was the first governor to respond, and in fact, the only governor to respond to a plea by President Ford at that period to provide a refuge for these very people who had worked with us in the Vietnam War, very similar to Iraqis and other people who have worked with us in conflicts abroad. He created the first Bureau of Refugee, and he actually opened up the state of Iowa to accept the first the Thai Dam, which was a tribal group within Laos and Vietnam, to come into our state. So really, Iowa was in the forefront of being the model host state for refugees. And this was under a Republican governor who said this had nothing to do with politics. It was about who we were and who our legacy was as Iowans.
Let's listen to a little bit of then-Governor Robert Ray in the late 1970s welcoming these refugees from Southeast Asia.
For you, it has been a long and difficult journey, which began months ago when you made the fundamental decision to leave your native land and set out in search of a place where you could live in freedom.
Okay, so these people, the Hmong who followed, the Thai Dam, other refugees from Asia are with us, and they have had children, and their children have had children. So they are part of the diverse fabric of Iowa these days.
No, exactly. For example, one of my students at the University of Iowa, his family was part of the boat people from Vietnam, and he grew up in Davenport. And now he's one of our leading students on campus who's participating in the Climate Narrative Project and all sorts of activities on campus. Someone who has really contributed to who we are as Iowans. If we think of the Bosnian refugees in the 1990s now, who have really helped so much of our communities, both in Cedar Rapids and in Davenport and areas like that, to for example, the largest immigrant group we have now is the Burmese, who have played a very important role in the transitioning of a lot of our aging agricultural communities to rejuvenate them and to actually give them new life around Cedar Falls, around Des Moines, and many rural areas of Iowa.
Jeff, your pieces this week make me wonder what has changed. Put that question in my head. Of course, a lot more people in the United States, about 100 million more American citizens on our soil, and the threat of terrorism.
Sure. I think we have to really go back to who Robert Ray was and really think of what has happened to Iowa since we lost Robert Ray as our governor. Someone who said, we can't just let those people die. You know, think of our own situation if we were in the same boat. It's someone who realized our history didn't begin yesterday with this kind of polarization of our politics, that people are making decisions based not on humanity, not on our legacy, not on our history, not on who we are in Iowa, but basically making decisions based on politics and the polarization between the Democrats and Republicans. And I think a lot of that has come into play now, really, in an unfortunate way. When I think of truly what is happening in Iowa, I think more of the Sudanese community, for example. Here in Iowa City, we have 2,500 Sudanese who've come into our community who now are playing an incredible role in terms of being active in our schools, being active in our communities, starting food projects, working with Johnson County. And I think this is areas in which we have to look beyond the polarization of politics to realize that we have so much to earn and so much to gain from welcoming the contributions of immigrants.
Jeff, you're not only a journalist and historian, but you're also a playwright. You also wrote a piece about Poet Laureate Mary Swander's latest play, which has an immigrant theme.
Right. Mary Swander is really one of our national treasures here in Iowa. She's not only an acclaimed poet and who's written histories and memoir, but she's written several very important plays. Her most recent play is called Vang, and Vang is the word for garden or farm for the Hmong. And so Mary spent 3 years collecting stories of immigrants and refugees in Iowa to understand how they're rejuvenating our agricultural communities and really changing who we are in a very positive way. She interviewed a refugee from the Sudan who had to leave a war-torn area. He came to Des Moines. He worked as he went to school. He earned a Ph.D. in sustainable agriculture, and now he's a professor at the same time working in our farming communities. She interviewed a Hmong family who become the mainstay of a Des Moines farmers market. She interviewed Latinos and Mexican and Mexican-Americans in Marshalltown who have been very active in their community programs. And then she went to Brooklyn, Iowa, where there's a growing community of Dutch farmers. And we tend to forget immigration is not only from war-torn areas, but we have a growing immigration now also from Europe. And the Dutch actually are coming in and rejuvenating our dairy industry. And so Mary brought this together, for a very important play to really talk about immigrants and farming and who we are as Iowans. You know, and I'd like to add, too, that Mary's play has toured nationally from New York to California, and it's had just a tremendous impact. And, in fact, it's gone to many little communities in Iowa. For example, we're going to be doing a special production on Sunday, February 12th, at the historic Old Capitol. That'll be not only staging the production of Vang, but bringing together immigrant and older Iowan communities to really discuss these issues of immigration and agriculture.
Okay, Jeff Biggers, thank you for your input today. Iowa City-based journalist, historian, and playwright, Jeff Biggers. Check out his work this week on the Huffington Post's website, reminding us of Iowa's rich history in the treatment of refugees and immigrants. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Of course, this week's news dominated by a reaction to President Trump's travel ban, those executive orders temporarily halting travel to the U.S. by residents of those seven majority Muslim countries, also suspending refugee admissions for 120 days, and indefinitely shutting down the admission of Syrian refugees to the United States. Now, another perspective on that, let's go to the ACLU of Iowa, starting off by mentioning how last weekend the American Civil Liberties Union, this is the nationwide American Civil Liberties Union, shattered all previous fundraising records. It received more than $24 million from over 350,000 online donations. $24 million in one weekend. To give you some perspective, that's an impressive sum, especially when you consider the ACLU nationally typically only receives $4 million a year from online donations. Slate reporting, since Election Day, the ACLU's membership has doubled to 1 million members. So now let's zoom in from that national picture to learn about the ACLU in our state. Joining us, Rita Bettis, Interim Program Director and Legal Director for the ACLU of Iowa. Hello again, Rita.
Hi, Ben. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Of course, some policy things I want to ask you about here, but first of all, those numbers of your fundraising, how has the fundraising been here in Iowa since the election and the membership?
Well, I'm so glad you asked about that. So, you know, I think it's been incredible. People view the ACLU as the last line of defense. People are watching what's happening both at the national level and President Trump's executive orders, concern about what this incoming Congress is going to do. And then right here in Iowa, we, of course, have had a sea change politically, too, and we have a number of things that impact people's rights at a core level. And so, you know, the ACLU is here, and I think we saw over this weekend we are going to make good on our promises to do everything we can to stand up for people and protect fundamental rights and equality in this country.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any specific numbers about ACLU membership here in Iowa and fundraising here in Iowa?
What I can tell you is we've seen a lot of support, and we've seen that not only in fundraising but in offers to volunteer. We've had more than two dozen new attorney volunteers since the inauguration, so it's been incredible. I will say we need support at the state and local level, too. So we really would be very grateful and encourage folks to go to the ACLU of Iowa's website or give us a call and become a member, make a donation. We will put those dollars to work right here in Iowa through litigation and through lobbying in the Iowa legislature, through our advocacy right here in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. I want to get to the legislative items that you mentioned, but first of all, overall, the travel ban repercussions, reaction from across the country. What are you hearing from Iowans that get in touch with you? What is of most concern?
You know, it's been a mess for people. I think, you know, so as folks know, last week President Trump made good on a campaign promise that he had made to try to ban Muslims from entering this country. And the ACLU also made good on a promise it made to go into court and try to stop him when that happened. So this is a ban on Muslims coming into the country. It's temporary. It's for 90 days. And it's under the pretext of national security, but obviously it's an ethnic and religious-based discriminatory policy.
So you don't buy it that you don't buy the administration saying this is geographically based. This is not a Muslim ban. This is from seven countries that are very unstable and we need to protect ourselves from.
So the executive order on its face makes clear that that's not the case because it's obviously targeting majority Muslim countries and then it's making exceptions for minority religions from those majority Muslim countries. And then, of course, this didn't happen in a vacuum. This happened after a long campaign of really ugly rhetoric targeting Muslims. So absolutely not. We don't buy that. And, you know, I'll tell you, it goes against everything that our country was founded on right from the beginning. Our founding fathers intended that this would be a country where people would be free from religious persecution, discrimination on the basis of religion. And so here in Iowa, the ACLU was successful, not just in that big case in New York on Friday, but also in a series of other cases around the country in getting some parts of this stay blocked. And one of the things that we did right here in Iowa was to make sure that no one was detained in any airports in Iowa, and thankfully no one was. But we have had Iowans who have been impacted either because they're students who were stuck abroad, unable to come into the country, or Iowans who have family members who have visas who are scheduled to come in, who then were impacted because they don't know how that is going to be impacted now with the executive order. So we've been doing what we can to assist them, provide information so that they can make the best decisions for them so that they and their family members will be safe and hopefully be able to be reunited. One thing that we took part in yesterday, all of the ACLU affiliates across the country filed a FOIA with our regional and in other parts of the country, state-based border patrol entry ports. So the closest for Iowa is in Chicago. And we have asked for all of the information that we think is relevant to what we are experiencing, which is refusal by the Center for Border Patrol to comply with the court order, staying parts of the executive order, problems that people are still having, either not being able to fly into the country or finding that they are subject to this enhanced screening procedure and detention when they get here. And then, of course, there's also the immigration order that was filed the day before the Muslim ban. The executive order that was filed the day before the Muslim ban executive order. And that one focused on immigration priorities and immigration enforcement. Mm-hmm. And that could have some really problematic impacts here in Iowa. We don't yet know how sanctuary jurisdictions will be defined. We don't know if the federal government intends to seek to require local law enforcement to violate the Fourth Amendment rights of immigrants through these detainer ICE requests or not. I think there's a worry about that, and it remains to be seen. But the ACLU is going to stand by those law enforcement officers across the state of Iowa and across the country in resisting that if that happens. It's certainly a violation of the 10th Amendment in commandeering local and state law enforcement for these federal immigration purposes. And it also exposes counties to legal liability. So courts around the country have held that, you know, when ICE sends these detainer requests saying hold a person without a warrant or other legal authorization, ICE may make the request, but it's the local law enforcement officers who then hold someone in violation of the Fourth Amendment who end up liable when that person's constitutional rights are violated and they sue.
Rita Bettis is with us of the Iowa ACLU. To get to some legislative items that the ACLU is concerned about here in Iowa, briefly, if I could, let's go to these, I think, four items here. Under an Iowa Senate bill co-sponsored by nine Republican lawmakers, people who intentionally block traffic on Iowa highways would be charged with a felony, punishable by up to 5 years in prison. Rita, this is, as you know, a response to an incident in November, directly after the election, when more than 100 protesters blocked I-80 near Iowa City. They shut down traffic going east for about 30 minutes. Some had to be removed by law enforcement. So certainly we can understand that's a dangerous situation to have people blocking an interstate. What's the position of the ACLU on this bill?
Well, of course, we are against this bill. And this is really part of a trend we're seeing that's really worrisome across the country, that seems to be in response to the activism, the assembling, the protected assembling and demonstrations that we're seeing across the country. You know, I think, so there's this bill in Iowa. I know there's a bill that would even allow people to run down protesters with their cars. So these are obviously, I mean, to say that they're problematic and worrisome is an understatement.
But people are allowed to protest peacefully, but they don't have to protest on a highway. We have free speech, but isn't safety also a big concern here?
Absolutely, and I think it's important to know that these concerns are already addressed in Iowa law. I mean, those folks in Iowa City were able to be cleared from the highway. And, you know, this is not something where we need an extremely punitive approach in order to deal with this protected right of expression. It has a chilling effect far beyond those individuals who may intentionally enter onto a highway with the purpose of stopping traffic, which is probably not most of them, to be honest. So, you know, we really are concerned about this. In our system of government where power flows from the people to the government and not the other way around, protected expression, demonstration, First Amendment protest activity, it's a source of strength in our democracy and not the other way around. So we are going to do what we can to protect those First Amendment rights. And, you know, I think it's important to note that while the proponents have sought to draft this bill in a manner that may disguise it by not referring to protests or demonstrations specifically, they haven't been shy at all about making clear in their comments to the press that this is the right, this is about the right to peaceably assemble. So, you know, that's problematic when you're targeting speech because you disagree with the content of that speech and the motivation of the protesters. You're running right up against those protected First Amendment values.
In just a moment, we continue my conversation recorded earlier today with Rita Bettis of the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa. The ACLU nationwide has experienced a surge of donations and new members within the past few days. After a short break, I'll ask about the ACLU's opposition to the new voter identification proposal by Iowa's Secretary of State Paul Pate. Then Kay Henderson with an update about several news items at the State House, and I asked the superintendent of Des Moines schools about a statement the school district issued in reaction to Donald Trump's travel ban. I'm Ben Kiefer, back after a short break. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back midstream in this Friday News Buzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. In just a few moments, Kay Henderson of Radio Iowa with an update about several news items at the State House. Also, I'll ask the superintendent of Des Moines schools a little later about a statement that school district issued in reaction to Donald Trump's travel ban. But first, back to the rest of my conversation recorded earlier today with Rita Bettis, interim program director and legal director at the ACLU of Iowa.
Let's talk about another proposal, this one by the Secretary of State, a voter ID proposal. Paul Pate says his new voter identification proposal is an effort to improve administrative efficiency, not to prevent fraud or disqualify voters. I guess his idea, he says, is to streamline election administration across the state by bringing electronic voter databases to every precinct in every county of our state. He said also he would oppose any efforts by state lawmakers to expand the plan to include more controversial photo ID requirements for voters. But it would require all voters to present a state-issued identification card when casting a ballot. No registered voters, I guess, under this plan would risk disqualification under the plan, Pate said. You could have a provisional ballot if you didn't have that ID with you. So why not improve efficiency? The ACLU is not in favor of this.
we're staunchly opposed to this. And I think it's important. I'm glad you said paid sed. So before we ever saw this bill, our Secretary of State was on a sort of PR campaign, and we kept asking for the bill, and lots of folks kept asking for the bill, and instead we would just get talking points. And, you know, I think the talking points work a lot better than the actual bill as it's written. So it's not true that people wouldn't be disenfranchised or that people wouldn't be turned away or that this would make voting streamlined in any sense. So make no mistake, Paul Pate's voter ID bill, which is what it is, will make voting more difficult and more confusing for voters. It's also expensive for taxpayers. It would cost millions of dollars. The better it's implicated, the more public education that's provided for, the more voter outreach, the more expensive it's going to be. There are no funds available for that. There is no plan to even ask for funds for that. And, of course, there's no justification for this. Iowa has some of the best elections in the country. We have some of the highest rates of voter participation and zero indication of any voter impersonation fraud. So under Secretary Pate's proposal, we're making some very big changes. We're making voting a lot more confusing. We're making it more restrictive. Voters are going to be confused. Lines are going to be longer. And some voters are simply not going to be able to have their ballots counted because they lack one of these narrow classes of acceptable photo IDs. So poll workers would no longer be able to use a number of highly reliable forms of ID that we currently use to verify that voters are who they say they are when they take advantage of same-day voter registration. Those include high school, college, university student IDs, out-of-state government-issued IDs like driver's licenses from out-of-state, or employer-issued ID cards. And make no mistake, this bill will have disproportionate harm on the voting rights of a large number of Iowans, but especially African Americans, Iowans who are elderly, and Iowans who have disabilities. So, mm-hmm.
Paul Pate, the Secretary of State, says it's in the interest of efficiency. You question his motive here, really?
Well, I don't have insight into his motive. What I can tell you is that this is part of a trend of bills filed across the country to impose heightened restrictions to identify voters at the polls. And all of these bills, you know, this is not a new idea. Iowa is not coming to this right out of the gate as part of the initial wave. We know how these bills function across the country. We've seen what it does for voters, especially low-income minority voters, elderly voters, voters with disabilities, rural voters across the country. And we know that it makes lines longer. We know that it makes voting harder, both for poll workers and for individual voters. So we don't need to necessarily examine his motives because we know the impact that this bill is going to have. And, you know, let's talk about that. This bill creates two classes of voters, those who have one of these three forms of ID and those that don't. And for those that don't, the bill effectively ends same-day voter registration. So it's treating that class of voters significantly worse than voters who have these three forms of ID. And it's just, you know, to make very clear, this is one of the most restrictive forms of voter ID that we've seen by only accepting these three types of ID. For those people who don't pre-register, and that means register by 11 days before the general election, and who don't have one of these three forms of ID, they will not be able to get this free ID mailed to them in time that he's sort of offering and talking about in his talking points. That's not going to be available to people who don't pre-register. And let's not forget, they're eligible voters. It is not a requirement of your eligibility to vote, your constitutional right to vote, that you be someone who drives a car or has served in the military or has a U.S. passport.
Rita Bettis of the Iowa ACLU, finishing up our conversation with Rita Bettis here. One more point to get to in terms of the what's going on in the Iowa legislature, your position on this. The GOP-led Iowa Senate voted this Wednesday to expand Iowa's workplace drug testing law to include hair samples. Now, Iowa already lets companies demand blood, urine, saliva, breath samples from workers for random drug tests. Is it too far to go to hair samples? Why not hair samples?
Well, I should say we oppose Iowa's existing employer drug testing regime, and we obviously oppose the expansion of it. We think that employers shouldn't be able to discriminate against their employees or applicants on the basis of their conduct during non-working hours unless that conduct is actually affecting the employee's ability to
What if you're the driver of a semi and you have a company that employs drivers? Don't you want to know that that's a person who is not under the influence of drugs?
So if it's impacting an employee's ability to perform at work, I think that's a different question. And what we want to see are safeguards to protect employees' privacy and due process. So just some examples of some of the things that should be included in any type of policy that would allow for this type of intrusion by an employer into the privacy rights of the employee mm-hmm. are things like the employers should be required to notify employees and applicants of any monitoring policies, any drug testing policies. And the employers should only be conducting drug tests when there's a reasonable suspicion of alcohol or drug use. Random drug testing really shouldn't be permitted. Universal drug testing shouldn't be permitted unless there's some reasonable suspicion to justify it. Of course, employees should have due process rights. They should have the ability to contest the accuracy of the test results or the ramifications of the test. And then we think, if you're going to be requiring this sort of policy, there should be some provision in place to provide rehabilitation and treatment information and opportunities to people who are identified who may have a substance abuse problem. The results themselves should be confidential. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't be released without the written consent of the employee. So we don't have a good policy in place in Iowa. The hair testing extends it further, and we'd like to see some safeguards added, and we'll be asking the legislature to do that.
Okay. Rita Bettis, Interim Program Director and Legal Director of the Iowa ACLU. Thank you for sharing this time with us and giving the Iowa ACLU's positions on a number of the things that have popped up in recent weeks.
Thank you, Ben. It's been a pleasure.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Lots of politics, in fact, all politics on today's News Buzz, our quick conversations to round off the week on our talk shows. Well, as expected, things moving very quickly in Des Moines under the first unified Republican government here in Iowa in 20 years. Joining us now with an update on politics in our state capital, Kay Henderson, News Director for Radio Iowa. Hi, Kay.
Hello.
Let's talk about a few of the things that you've reported on for Radio Iowa in recent days. Planned Parenthood in the news. It has advanced in the State House.
Yes. Talk about the news buzz.
right.
It was buzzing at the State House this week when senators on a subcommittee and then a committee considered this legislation. It was among the largest protests I've ever covered at the State House. I was right there beside Sarah Bowden from Iowa Public Radio in a crowd where you could not move. You could actually breathe, but you couldn't move.
And your reporting goes back about how far, Kay?
Well, thank you. I started covering the legislature for Radio Iowa in 1987.
Okay, so.
And I spent 3 years before that with WI as a student.
So jam-packed there at the State House.
Yes, and the other thing, just sort of the interesting dynamic of the debate that occurred in the Senate last night was it seemed to mirror what's going on in the nation's capital. You had very aggressive Republican senators in Des Moines who were pushing back when a very aggressive and confrontational Democratic minority was challenging this law. So to me, it was fascinating. I didn't hear that same sort of vigorous debate when the Iowa House earlier this week considered a bill regarding budget cuts, but it was a dynamic discussion last night.
Mm-hmm. Any question about whether this will make it to the governor's desk to become law?
No, it will go to the governor, and he has indicated he will sign it.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the executive branch. You wrote this reported this week about the only independent in the Senate, David Johnson. He's been on this program, actually, when he left the Republican Party to become an independent. The question of whether Kim Reynolds, our current lieutenant governor, will get the title governor when Branstad leaves. Explain that, because they have people shaking their heads about that one.
Johnson is asking Iowa's attorney general to issue an official opinion. The attorney general's spokesperson issued a statement in December saying that after discussing it with the governor's office, they concur that the lieutenant governor will become the governor. Johnson is asking a series of 9 questions. For instance, is she just the acting governor? Does she actually get the title? Who has the authority to swear her in as governor? Does she have the authority to name a lieutenant governor? He is asking the lieutenant governor to weigh in on these things by February 15th. He's also suggesting that legislators may be called upon to clear things up. Again, as you mentioned, he is an independent. So he is sort of an David Johnson, senator from Ochiden in northwest Iowa, is sort of an island of his own at the legislature these days. So he doesn't have a lot of influence, but he has reached out to the attorney general and is trying to press this issue.
Mm-hmm. A budget update quickly, Kay?
One of the interesting things about the budget-cutting plan that the Governor Branstad approved this week is that it includes $11.5 million of undefined cuts that will be managed, if you will, by the Iowa Department of Management. So they have identified, you know, we're going to print fewer things, we're going to find other ways to economize. To some, it appears as a way for legislators not to cut as deeply as the governor did in areas such as the Department of Corrections and prisons, and we all saw what happened in Delaware this week. And also, legislators were not going to go along with the governor's $7.7 million cut to the courts. They only cut it $3 million. So I would expect that executive branch agencies are going to be squeezed even more than the budget outline that landed on the governor's desk.
Traffic cameras, a debate that we've talked about for years here. You reported on the future of traffic enforcement cameras. There is a, I'll say it, fork in the road, right?
Exactly. Well, there is a race, if you will, between two competing opinions in the Iowa Senate. There's a bill advancing that would allow the cameras but would give the Iowa Department of Transportation the authority to determine whether they are properly placed and where they may be placed, whereas there's another bill that would completely and outlaw them outright. So it's interesting to see where this may go. House Speaker Linda Upmeyer is the guest on this week's edition of Iowa Press on Iowa Public Television. When asked about this subject, she indicated that the sentiment in the House is to get rid of these things. So stay tuned.
Okay, quickly, as you look at the week ahead, the weeks seem like they pack in a month of politics and news. Sure seems like to those of us especially who work with it, Kay. What are you looking at for the coming days especially?
The legislature will be unveiling a collective bargaining proposal, and indications are that it will look a lot like the proposal that advanced out of the Iowa House in 2011 that changed the subjects which arbitrators ruling on contracts may consider. It also changed layoffs in that layoffs cannot be the subject of a contract. So a manager, when making layoffs, could lay off the most senior person rather than the current practice, which is people who have seniority are the last to be laid off.
Interesting. We'll watch that. Kay Henderson, news director for Radio Iowa, thanks for joining us for a few minutes this week. Have a great weekend, Kay.
You too.
And finally, to end our hour, this News Buzz edition, closing a week that has been dominated by reaction to Donald Trump's travel ban, fulfilling a campaign promise the president says will help better protect the U.S. from terrorism. Let's finish off with this reaction from the Des Moines Public Schools. Tom Ahart is with us, superintendent of the Des Moines Public Schools. Good afternoon to you, Tom.
Good afternoon to you, Ben.
Now, your school district issued a statement earlier this week written by you and also the school board chair. I wonder if you can start off our conversation here. We have just a few minutes. It's not a very long statement, but start off by reading it.
Sure. This weekend, much of the world's attention was focused on an effort by the federal government to impose far-reaching restrictions on the ability of immigrants and refugees to come to the United States. From protesters at airports and on the streets to lawyers and judges in courtrooms, there was a swift reaction by many in support of immigrants and refugees. To all of our students who are immigrants or refugees, and to their friends and classmates and teachers who are also concerned because of these recent events, know that you belong here, and Des Moines Public Schools stands by you. We want to help you learn and succeed in school. We want to see you have fun and make friends and find your passions. We want to be there to celebrate that day when you walk across a stage to receive your diploma. We want to help you grow into the people you want to become. At Des Moines Public Schools, we welcome immigrants and refugees as our students and families, as our neighbors and friends. Over the years, thousands of refugee students from around the world have attended school at DMPS. Our students, parents, and staff come from more than 100 nations, and each day dozens of different languages are heard in the hallways and classrooms of our schools. Our diversity of language and culture and heritage is a part of our strength in our school and throughout this community. When children in Des Moines show up at our schools, no matter their place of birth or religion or language or skin color, they should know that they belong here and we stand by them.
Superintendent Ahart, why did you and the others in leadership there at the school system in Des Moines feel this was needed?
Well, first of all, that's really how we try to live every day. But this year, probably starting as early as last spring, as what felt to us and to our students and families as perhaps a more contentious election season than in past years, there was lots of concern being expressed by a number of our students and families just about uncertainty as to their future, both here in Des Moines and in Iowa and in the country. And part of what we're charged with as a school system is to provide a safe place for our kids. And so we have a lot of folks working to support kids in a whole variety of ways, and anything we can do to ease tension and create a more healthy and nurturing environment, we're always looking for ways to improve the culture and climate.
I wonder, Tom, can you point to something that happened in your school, something that was said in your school system, perhaps passed on by a teacher, that really hit home with you and told you that this statement was needed?
Well, I can think of dozens of examples from both teachers and associates and principals and secretaries from a whole variety of our buildings. Anywhere from students not showing up at school because they felt it wasn't, you know, they just felt like they were sort of under attack, not at school, but just wanting to be with family and, you know, being afraid of being deported or of someone entering the building to get them, to literally dozens and dozens of kids just expressing fear and uncertainty about their future in the country and in the schools.
We only have about a minute left, but I wonder, are there contingency? We've spoken with school systems that have contingency plans should a child be at school and parents be deported. Do you have such plans?
Well, we have partnerships with a wide variety of community agencies, and so we're always at the ready to help provide support for kids, whether that's housing, meals, clothing, in the event that they're, for whatever reason, separated from family. And our school board is actually now in the process of developing a resolution, possibly two resolutions, at the upcoming board meeting to express support for these students and to urge political action on at least support of the Dreamer Act, the extenuation of the Dreamer Act, so that there's more certainty for some of these young immigrant and refugee students.
What was the feedback you heard from this statement and other actions you've taken in support of some of your students?
Frankly, most of the feedback that I've gotten has been overwhelmingly positive, probably of the emails, and it's mostly coming in through email. I would say it's probably about a 10-to-1 positive to negative in support of that statement.
Okay, thank you very much. Tom Ahart, superintendent of Des Moines Public Schools, commenting on the situation there. Of course, schools all across the U.S. and here in Iowa dealing with this travel ban because of our immigrant population here. Thank you so much, Superintendent Ahart.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon, with help from Chelsea Hoy. Tomorrow, Monday on the program, we'll talk about so-called collision sports. There's some work afoot at the legislature to deal with concussions and the like. Hope you'll tune in on Monday. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.